I found that people were hungry to do something that got them off the screen. And I think within a world where it feels like something different, something heartbreaking happens every single day, people just want to be able to touch a cause and be able to do something apart from just donating money to a cause. And so we set it up so that people could come onto the site at any time and they could nominate friends and family going through something tough, whether that was sickness, illness, if it was moving away or loss of a loved one, anything really, any walk of life. And we pick 8 to 10 stories that we put up online, and we give our audience the ability to sit down, write a letter, and mail it into a bundle that will end up being anywhere from usually 300 to 600 letters.
You're listening to episode 56 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? Before we get into today's interview, I wanted to thank Vermont College of Fine Arts for sponsoring today's episode. Their MFA writing program has been around for 35 years. At the end of the show, you'll find out why they're ranked one of the best low residency writing programs in the country. We have the amazing Hannah Brencher on the show with us today. Named as one of the White House's Women Working to Do Good, Hannah is a TED speaker and the author of the heartwarming memoir, If You Find This Letter. She's also the founder of the global organization called More Love Letters, whose mission is to use social media to write and mail letters to strangers all over the world. In Hannah's episode, we uncover the inspiration behind the love letters written to strangers and how it impacts people's lives. We go behind the scenes in running Hannah's organization and how she and her team are expanding to reach more people with their message. We also touch on a really important discussion about depression, and Hannah is incredibly honest and open. Guys, I'm so excited for you to check out this episode. Now let's dive right in. Hey everyone, we have Hannah Brencher with us today. Hannah, I'm so excited to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I am so excited to have you here. And I know just a little bit before we were chatting and getting ready for the interview, we were talking about the weekends and how it's important to try and make time for ourselves instead of trying to catch up with work. Because I know I have that habit as well, wanting to get ahead with work so I don't have to stress out too much during the weekdays. But it's nice to hear that you're kind of going through the same thing and making time for yourself.
It's been a struggle ever since I went self-employed, which was in 2012. It was this realization that if I wanted to, I could be working all the time. And while that did make me feel like I was getting ahead, I realized that was going to take a toll really quickly on my health. And so yeah. I feel like I'm finally getting to the end of the tunnel of saying, you know what, like the world is not going to fall apart if I don't do this on a Saturday. And, you know, I'm getting married in 4 months. And so it's kind of like, let's take in this season of engagement and this time with family and this time of just being with one another and being with friends, because I think at the end of my life, this is the stuff that I'm going to miss. It's not going to be whether I did a project on a Sunday or a Monday.
Yes, I'm nodding my head along. I totally agree with you. And by the way, congratulations on being self-employed, and also congratulations on your wedding coming up. That's exciting.
Yay, December.
Is this a college sweetheart?
We met last October and we are getting married in December.
I'm so pumped for you. I know you mentioned about family and friends. I absolutely agree. I'm a huge family person. And that really goes along with what you do too, your letters. And that does a lot for relationships, whether it's with the ones that you already know and love or with strangers. So I'd love for the audience to know that your mom wrote tons of letters for you, love letters, and hid them everywhere. Did you ever find one of your mom's love letters to you in the most unexpected place, and then it couldn't have come at a more perfect time in your life?
Yeah, I feel like that's been happening my whole life. And I didn't realize that it was out of the ordinary until I went off to college, that I had a lot of friends that didn't get letters or didn't have letters tucked places. But that's something that my grandmother actually used to do for her children. And then my mother has passed it on to me. She does it after every trip, every time she sees me. It's obviously a little bit harder to do now that I live 16 hours away from her. But I always know that if she's coming to visit or I'm visiting her, there's always going to be a note somewhere, whether I look in my bag and look in places to find it, or if I find it months later. Even if I'm finding letters that I've already discovered from her, they meet me at the most opportune moments, the moments where I just need to know that my mom is there and she cares and that I'm not alone. And so it's crazy how my mom's small gestures have created such a larger movement.
My mom also used to write little love notes to me as well, but then she wouldn't hide it though. It's very in your face when you're brushing your teeth, it's right in the mirror, and it's words of encouragement and you work hard, you'll get there, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, okay, mom, I get it. But yours is so cute and sentimental that your mom hides it in little places. So it's like little surprises throughout the weeks and even months. I don't know many people whose parents would take the time out of the day. Looking back on it now that you're older, were you a confident kid growing up?
Because of my mother, I think I always possessed a quiet confidence. I would not say that I was like every other child out there. I mean, I really didn't even like hanging out with other kids. If you had left me to my own devices, I would be the one that was inside writing books, creating, putting on plays by myself. And I did this every single day after school. And I remember my mom would have play dates and I didn't want to be with the other kids. I just wanted to be off on my own making up stories. And that's really definitely helped me in the career that I'm in today, doing something that is kind of out of the box and a little bit out of the ordinary. And so the greatest thing that my mom instilled in me, especially through those letters, is that it's okay to be different and you are exactly who you are for a reason. And so you don't have to change or try to fit in with everybody else. And going through high school and college, that's really hard because you want to fit in. You just want to do anything you can to not break the mold. And I think my mom just always encouraged my gifts. She encouraged my gifts to be a writer, encouraged my gifts to be a leader. She never made me feel like I was wrong for that or that I should go a different route or direction. Like, she was never the mom that pushed me into sports or competitive things if I didn't want to do that. It was very much let her be who she's going to be, let her march to the beat of her own drum. And that has made all the difference, especially today being 28.
She also needs to have her own talking engagements and teach parents how to be really amazing. There's so many who helicopter their kids and they never grow up. And there's also those who don't give enough time. But your mom sounds like the perfect mom.
I think the biggest thing, though, people are always shocked to hear it, that like my mom, it wasn't up until this last year did she actually get a cell phone throughout my whole childhood. Yeah.
Oh my God.
The only reason she got one is because, one, she kind of was realizing how you catch up with your kids' lives is through social media, and she wanted to be caught up on our lives, but she was starting to travel. Like, she just retired, and so my dad and her have been traveling all over the place, and so she got a cell phone to just stay in touch with people. But up until that point, she really taught me, this is how you're present to people, and this is how you respect people, and really just taught me that the things on the screen can wait. Somehow we all got cell phones, and then they became the most vital thing to us, like our third arm. And she's the one that will do a quirky message on the voicemail at home. I don't even know what you call it, the voice recorder thing, the answering machine. She still uses that, and like people love it, and they call in every holiday season because she'll do a message in Spanish, even though she's not Spanish, but she speaks Spanish. She got unicycle classes to learn how to ride a unicycle. She just really instilled in me, if you want to do something, then go out there and do it no matter what. A few years ago, she was taking a sunflower painting, like sunflower mural painting class where you paint sunflowers onto murals. I have no idea where she found this class, but she would be in the backyard painting murals of sunflowers. She just really has always instilled in me, like, the most important thing you can do for your life is be present, let people know what they mean to you.
You writing these letters is huge because, like you said, everyone's glued to their screens, and writing these letters are totally a break from technology and just bringing it back to the basics. One of the original ways of expressing love and showing that you're cared for. Do you remember that moment, that turning point or the catalyst that the idea of your memoir would come to be?
The story behind the organization and what would eventually lead up to the memoir was never anything that I planned. It wasn't like, oh, I would love to live this really great story and then write about it. It was very much like everything happened by accident, but at the same time, I look back and realize like none of it was an accident. It was all supposed to happen in the way that it did. But yeah. I mean, the backstory is really just that I I moved to New York City right after college, and I had my big plans to change the world and be a mover and a shaker and all those things that I'd gone to a very small college. And so they really invested in us as individuals. And then you move to New York City, where it's like no one knows your name and no one really cares to know your name, and you feel really lost in the crowd. And I ended up struggling with what I know now to be depression. At that time, I didn't know to call it depression. I thought it was just a matter of I can get stronger, I can get better, I will beat these feelings. And I didn't know how to actually call it what it was. I didn't know that it was a mental illness at the time. And so to deal with the loneliness of New York City, that was when I started to pick people out on the subway and in coffee shops, and I would write them a letter. And at first, I didn't have the courage to do anything but write a letter and leave it in my notebook. But I started to rip those letters out and leave them around New York City and leave them in places where somebody would find them and they would know themselves loved. Just imagining what it would be like for me on that lonely commute and going through a city where no one really knows your name and finding a letter that basically is telling me that I matter and that it matters that I'm here. And I ended up just blogging about that, like really briefly on my blog that at the time, like really didn't have very many readers. Blogging was a very new thing for me. And I said to my blog readers, whoever was out there, that if they wanted a love letter, I would write to them. In the next 9 months, I spent majority of my time writing a little over 400 letters to strangers everywhere, all over the world. People would donate postage. I would write to every kind of ailment, illness, stage of life that you could imagine. And that was when I really realized, wow, we're missing something here. Like, we're definitely missing something if you reach out to a 22-year-old girl and you ask her to write you a love letter because no one in your life is showing up for you. It was kind of the tipping point where I really couldn't turn away from what was happening. I couldn't pretend that I didn't see it. And so that was where more love letters ended up being built, was me not wanting to do it alone anymore and me wanting other people to experience what I had experienced through writing and leaving the letters. And so it took on a life of its own. And from there, it was a lot of press and a lot of crazy awesome things that put the story out there. But I think that that's really like sharing the story and not being silent about it is what led to me realizing like, wow, there is a book here.
Moving to New York and sitting on the subways, because I understand how that feels. I was on the subway all the time growing up and going to college as well, and then auditioning there as an actor. I can definitely relate to that loneliness. Do you remember that one person, perhaps the first person you can remember clearly that inspired a letter from you to them?
I do. I remember it pretty clearly. I remember coming home from work. It was another day of trying to forge through the feelings of depression, not knowing that it was not my fault and that I wasn't in control of this. And so at the end of the days, I would just be really tired and really defeated. And I remember sitting on the subway and a crowd of people had come in, and this woman, she pulled out from the crowd and she ended up sitting right across from me, and she looked really tired. I remember that she had a red cap on and there was like dirt on her clothes. Like, she just kind of looked like she had been through the ringer, and I didn't know much about her. And I also knew, though, in New York City, you don't really just go sit across at the other seat and talk to somebody. You know, you just don't strike up a conversation unless somebody looks at you. I just remember thinking, I wish I could say something to her. I wish I could talk to her. It just felt like the sadness that was all over her face was something that I really was feeling on the inside. But I also remember feeling like she and I probably couldn't be more different than one another. Here I was dressed up, wearing my heels, wearing my pencil skirt. And during that time, the only reason that I was even in New York City was because I was doing a year of volunteer service. And so volunteer service, basically, that you agree to make no money for the year. They give you housing and a food stipend, and they give you $25 a week. And so $25 a week is hard, and $25 a week in New York City is like unheard of since everything costs money. Yeah. It really supercharged the depression because I became very aware of the poverty in my neighborhood and the poverty around me. And I was living in the Bronx, New York, on the third floor of an immigration center. And so all of this was just kind of this perfect storm that sitting there on the subway and looking at this woman and realizing like, I'm never going to go talk to her. And it feels like everybody looks like this woman in the sense that she just looks so down and she looks like she's just been kicked down, that for reasons I'll probably never understand, I pulled out a notebook and I just started to write a letter to her, not knowing her name, not knowing anything about her life, but just kind of imagining what she would want to read. And I remember getting so engrossed in that process of writing the letter that when I looked up after finishing the letter, she had actually left the train. She'd exited at some point between coming home from Manhattan to getting to Fordham Road. And so that was when I just realized in that moment of writing that letter that I wanted to write another one, because it was the first time in the last few weeks that I hadn't been thinking about my sadness or my depression or how to get out of this thing, but I had just focused on somebody else.
And then what did you do with that letter after she left?
That letter kind of was the catalyst for writing a bunch more letters before I was back on a train. And I realized I didn't need these letters. I wasn't going to read the letters again. It was kind of weird to be keeping them in my notebook. And so I ended up ripping out one of the letters and folding it up and writing on the front of it, "If you find this letter, it's for you." I left it behind on the subway. I remember ripping it out of my notebook and writing on it and like being very careful not to let anybody see me doing this, because I just felt if somebody saw me, they'd be like, "What is this girl doing here?" And so I put it behind the seat, and when the doors open, I like bolted out of the door. Like it was like I left something behind that I shouldn't have left behind, but I was like terrified. I bolted out, but I also felt really exhilarated knowing like I had just left a piece of me, and that just became the thing I was hooked on, was like leaving letters in different places, whether it was in a bookstore or in the cover of my favorite book or in a coffee shop where busy coffee shops where I knew that somebody was going to be sitting down the second I got up from the seat. And it just became my way of just being able to sign off and not let anybody know who I was, but leave these parts of me behind.
It sounds so freeing, just leaving a part of you and then them not knowing your identity.
A lot of people have asked me when I started doing it, "Oh, do you leave your contact information away for people to find you?" And during those first initial letters, I didn't leave anything behind, because I don't think that was really my point. For me, it felt really, maybe it's the writer in me, but it felt really romantic to be able to leave a part of myself behind.
Yeah.
Letters of encouragement, but they also kind of felt like letters of my diary, because I was able to be real and honest about struggling with this loneliness and this sadness that just would not get off of my back. And so I think like looking back on the story, as romantic and whimsical as it seems to be, a young woman leaving letters around New York City, that was never how it felt when I was inside of it. It felt just like, this is the one thing that makes me not think about my sadness, so I am just going to do whatever I can to hold on.
What was it that you had in your mind that you were hoping to do or to set out after you graduate?
I did go to school for journalism, English and sociology, but I had gotten this job during my volunteer year as a liaison to a human rights organization at the United Nations. And so it was such a huge opportunity to be 22 and graduating from college, going to work at the United Nations. And that was what I thought would be, I guess, my 5-year plan, my 10-year plan, was that I was going to be in this field. That was how I was going to make a dent. I was going to work with human rights, whether that was education or sustainability or clean water or food for people that were hungry and starving. I was going to do something in that field that really fit into the classic box of world changing. And I realized like now that what I do does change lives and it does change the world in a lot of ways, but I never knew that I would be called to something that was way more that we deal with in the more industrialized countries, which is the feelings of loneliness and like the poverty of the spirit, of being so connected and so wired that we're actually more disconnected than ever before, and we're actually lonelier than ever before. And I had no idea that that was where I was going to invest my life.
That's the moment where you were depressed, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I went several months without having that diagnosis. I ended up going to find a therapist in January of that year. So I had moved to New York City in August, and the depression came on very quickly. I think it was definitely escalated because of the seasons changing and how I'm way more apt to become sadder when it is colder weather. But it was building for a while. And in January, when I really couldn't get out of bed, really didn't know what was wrong with me, feeling like where is the light at the end of this tunnel? I like searched on Google for a therapist in New York City. It's the stupidest thing you could ever do. But I found this one guy. I don't even know what made me choose him. And I went up to his little office because it was by the UN and we were talking. And by the end of it, he told me that I had depression. And I remember just thinking like, there's no way that I could have depression. Depression happens to other people, but I can't imagine why it would happen to me. And I felt really guilty about it because I thought my life has to be harder for me to deal with depression. And I think that's one of those stigmas and those lies about depression that keep people from being able to be diagnosed and actually find help. And so I remember him basically telling me that they didn't accept my insurance. And so I could not afford to go to this therapy, especially with my $25 a week. But he saw the work that I was doing and the volunteer work that I was doing in the Bronx. And he said, you know, I want to do good too. And so I want to offer you this therapy pro bono. And he did that for me for the next 6 months that I was living in New York City.
And do you feel that was helpful?
Yeah, I definitely think it was helpful to work with a therapist and to be able to talk out my problems and not keep it all to myself. I would have just kept it all to myself if I didn't have somebody to talk to. And I realized that opening up is one of the first ways that depression really loses its power. It was definitely, looking back now and seeing therapists that I've worked with more presently, like the therapists that I have now, it probably wasn't the best route of therapy, but for the time, it was really helpful for me to have somebody to share with and talk to, and for me to have that diagnosis, for me to know, okay, this isn't a matter of get stronger. This is an actual real illness that I'm going to have to fight through. And like you said, probably will have to fight through it for the rest of my life. And it wasn't until I went through a second round of depression last year did I actually understand that and grasp that, because I thought depression was a one and done thing. I thought if I dealt with it once, that meant it was not coming back like the chicken pox. And I've learned since that depression is something that I will probably battle for my whole life. And I want to become stronger in that and be more of an advocate for those that are going through that.
Have you talked to your mom about having depression? Is that something that she was surprised to learn?
Yeah, she was definitely surprised. I think she had kind of the same kind of stigmas as I did. But at the same time, we were able to uncover a lot of things that depression runs in my family. Depression and obsessive compulsive disorder. I actually have a long history of drug abuse in my family. And a lot of therapists and a lot of mental health professionals will say that people that cannot deal with the loneliness or the sadness will take comfort in the bottle or the pills or whatever it is that they can find that they can kind of get that will swallow up that pain. And so it's definitely been that battle to face depression naturally and to try to overcome it naturally. But I understand a lot more knowing that my father has dealt with that depression, my brother has dealt with that depression, my grandfather has dealt with that depression, and that it runs on both sides of the family.
I'm so interested in that topic because I'm from an Asian cultural background, and it's very much like, oh, there's almost like no such thing as a depression for the older generation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for my mom, I think she's very much like, what? It's all in the mind.
Yeah.
And that pisses me off. Like, I love her dearly, but you can't just shut off depression. She's like, you know, think positive. I'm like, okay, you can think positively, but doesn't subtract or negate how you're truly feeling. My mom comes from that old school thinking where, you know, put a smile on your face and you're fine.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Your mom is so interesting to me, and she just sounds so understanding and empathetic in that mention it runs on your mom's side too. And yeah. If she's dealt with it, and if maybe if she has, is that why she wrote letters too? Because that helps her in a way.
She might have found that to be a little bit indirectly. I mean, my mom has a very strong sense of faith. And so I think that a lot of what she does stems out of that faith. And just realizing as she's gone through life that people need to be boosted and people need to be reminded that they matter and that it matters that they're here. For her, it was harder because she's watching her daughter struggle with this in New York City. And it's like the training wheels have been taken off and she can't just come and make everything better for me. It was the first struggle that she couldn't really just make better. And I think she just was like, well, if it's hard, then you can come home. Just come home. Like, and I'm not a quitter. Like, I'm like, no, I will finish and it will be done well. And so her watching me go through two rounds of depression and knowing that she was helpless to stop it, she will immediately want to be the one to be, okay, well, if you're more likely to be depressed, if you go through self-employment and you are your own boss and you go through seasons of busyness and then seasons where you don't have much to do, then you should just go get a job somewhere where that won't be an issue anymore and that will be taken off the table. And I think that's just out of her nature. To not want me hurting. She wants to be able to help and control in some ways the sadness. And I come from a different camp that she's learned and realizing as we go is like, just because I deal with this doesn't mean I'm going to run away from this thing. And that, especially if my calling is really interlaced with depression and dealing with depression in a real way that will help other people, if I have to go through it another time or two more times or whatever it is, like, I'm willing to do that because I feel like there's something deeper and bigger than me in this. And so I think going through this with my mom two times has really helped her to see and understand depression and see it for the mental illness that it is, rather than, like I was talking about earlier, like a matter of get stronger and do better. Like, she knows I'm one of the most driven people that she's come across. And so she also knows, wow, that's really unnatural for her to not be able to get out of bed, for her to not be able to push herself and drive herself. And so she's come along on the journey to learn as much as she possibly can with me.
Yeah, absolutely. And also seeing, you know, her bearing witness, seeing how you mentioned earlier, your dad and your brother also struggled with depression, but reverted to alcohol or drugs, and you chose a different way of handling it. It's very new. And I'm sure her viewpoint, especially in the beginning, is like my mom's, where it's out of protection. But then to see you choosing the way to handle it and try to push through, I'm sure makes her so proud, really so yeah. proud, you know? And I'm sure it's new, very new for her. And it's also like, okay, I'm so proud of my baby girl who did not choose to go the other route or choose a different way of dealing with it, even though it still hurts any mom to see their child suffering. Totally have a crush on your mom-daughter relationship. I think it's so inspiring.
Oh, thank it really, you.
It's very rare. And thank you for letting me totally unpack your relationship with your mom and being so open about it. It's definitely something that connects all of us because we all have our own quirky relationships with our parents and everybody's relationship is very different. But at the core, we all want to be loved and we all want to be heard. And it sounds like you are being loved and heard. I admire you both, you and your mom.
Oh,
I
mean, that's thank awesome. You.
Yeah, seriously. You're the founder and creator of The World Needs More Love Letters. That is the name of your organization. Where is it today? It started how many years ago again?
This is our fifth year.
My goodness, congratulations. This is amazing. This is very huge and exciting. And it's something that really matters, really makes people happy. It makes people feel loved. And that's the most important thing. On your website, your one mission is to make love famous.
Yeah.
Now that deserves all the fame. You guys have over 11,000 love letters.
I mean, we started 5 years ago and it just blew up very quickly, which it's exactly like that mission says, like make love famous, is that people are hungry for something like this. I found that people were hungry for the tangibility of it. They were hungry to do something that got them off the screen. And I think within a world where it feels like something different, something heartbreaking happens every single day. People just want to be able to touch a cause and be able to do something apart from just donating money to a cause. And so we set it up so that people could come onto the site at any time and they could nominate friends and family going through something tough, whether that was sickness, illness, if it was moving away or loss of a loved one, anything really, any walk of life. And we pick 8 to 10 stories that we put up online and we give our audience the ability to sit down, write a letter and mail it into a bundle that will end up being anywhere from usually 300 to 600 letters. And so it is a massive bundle of letters that are showing up at somebody's door on a day when they don't think that anybody showing up for them. We've watched this grow to all 50 states, over 70 countries, and we have sent 250,000 love letters out into the world.
Oh my God. And here I am saying 11,000. Oh my goodness. Apologies on that. I
know. Totally. Don't worry.
That's amazing, Hannah. Congratulations. Oh my
Thank
gosh.
You.
I feel so proud of you and your organization. And I'm just meeting you today. This is incredible.
Thank you.
I mean, how many writers do you have on your staff?
We used to, when letters would come in, we would write letters back to the people. We did that for about like, want to say about a year that we did that. And then we realized like, wow, this is definitely not sustainable. We cannot, unfortunately, we could not get to every single person that was requesting a love letter. And so we switched up the model so that it would really be on our audience to be the ones to write those letters. And so I have a team of 8 people with me, and they are, one is manning the social media. One is kind of our like team cheerleader. She kind of keeps the team just structured and together, especially when I'm traveling, doing speaking engagements and really can't pour in as much. We have 3 girls that are awesome that run our whole campus cursive chapters. We're established on, I believe it's a little over 60 college campuses around the world. And so these are colleges that come in, they make an official club or organization at their school, and they really just, they love on their campus and love on their student body, especially since college is a time where depression does run high, where just a lot of these peer pressures come into play. And so they man that field and make sure that our campus leaders are taken care of. It's evolved, and I say $250,000, knowing that that's what we have documented for bundles and for different events that we've done, but I can imagine it's probably a lot more since we see on Instagram, we see people that are hosting events that are apart from us, but inspired by our mission. And so I can only imagine the amount of love letters that have actually been sent out because of the mission. Just something as simple as you can write a letter to somebody that you love.
How did you find your team?
I mean, when I first started, I was like, I'm just going to build a team. And I put a thing on the website. It said team needed. I had no idea what I was doing.
But that's the way to start, you know? That's how you learn.
Yeah, and I think that I'm pretty sure of the original team, there are no longer anyone from the original team. The last person kind of stepped out because she just had a baby. But it's crazy how, like, that original team trickled into more people coming on board. We just found people that really loved the mission and were dedicated to the mission. I remember there was one event that I had to do at the boutique Sea Wonder in New York City, and they wanted love letter writers for Valentine's Day at 4 of their locations around New York City. And I just like, again, put it out there, like, we need professional love letter writers. And like, who knows who's a professional love letter writer, but people, they applied and we picked them. And one of the girls is still on the team from that event. It's been finding the people that know and understand the heart of this mission and really are working for the good of people is the most important thing. They're very tireless in their role and they put a lot of hard work into it. And I cannot imagine the organization would be what it is without their consistent pouring in.
Do you have a long-term vision for the organization?
Right now, what we are doing is we're developing a model for community chapters. That's kind of like what I always assumed would be the last piece of the puzzle, is that I love that More Love Letters is a place on the internet, but I think that if we want to really combat these things like depression, loneliness, anxiety, people feeling isolated, disconnected, then we have to bring it full circle to people meeting face-to-face and people meeting in person. I'm a big advocate for being online and being on social media. Like, that can definitely help you feel less alone, and there are times and seasons in your life for that, but the most growth that has ever come to me has been through actually knowing people off the screen and being involved in bigger missions. And so we are working on a model very similar to our campus cursive chapters, where people, wherever you are, if you're in Charleston or you're in Raleigh or you're in Atlanta, you would be able to meet up as a group to write these letters. And it would be a chance to commune with one another and have time with one another and get real with one another, but you're also surrounding yourself around a bigger mission. And so that's kind of how we're figuring out how to execute that, especially when we've seen, you know, we've seen so many things recently in the news. I think it started with Charleston, and then we had the tragedy of what happened in Orlando, and it was a lot of people reaching out being like, we want to write letters to this cause or this cause or this cause. And unfortunately, we cannot write towards when a city or a community is having a crisis, because we are not the experts on that city. And we want that to be something that somebody who is on the ground would be able to facilitate and manage. And that's why we really feel the need for community chapters, that if your city is struggling or your community is going through something tough, you are still able to get love letters to that area and be able to spread the bigger mission of More Love Letters on a more grassroots level, which is kind of crazy because most people start grassroots and it eventually goes global. Yeah. This thing started global and now
it's reverse.
It's reverse. There was never a thing in my mind that was like, this is going to be a small group for me. It was just always the world needs this, as the name of the organization is, like, the world needs more love letters and we're going to do this. And now we're realizing, we're like, wow, the last piece of our puzzle would be going back to grassroots so that this is a mission that can be invested in the hearts and the minds of many people that are able to say that they have their own piece of the movement where they are, and their community and city and lives have been made better because of it.
The way you've grown it is brilliant, and just spreading your message even more and more. Is that something that you came up with yourself, like these chapters, or did you brainstorm with someone in your team?
Everything is a result of brainstorming with a team, for sure. But yeah, I think the reason we even chose to do campus chapters and get it on college campuses was because of the fact, like, one, I had been really heavily involved in student activities when I was in college. And so I kind of just knew that people love joining clubs. They love joining groups. And, like, that's where you find the like-minded people around you for that 4 years, however long it is. But at the same time, I had written a love letter. I remember it was in December of our second year of More Love Letters. We needed content to fill the blog. I was sick, and I wrote this letter for students going through final exams. And I, like, posted on the blog. A couple hours later, it's like 50,000 people have read it, and then 100,000 people have read it, and it's going viral, like, by the minute. And we just realized, like, as we're getting all these emails from college students that are crying at their desk and freaking out, and somebody printed out the letter and left it all over the library, and, like, this letter is literally getting passed from person to person to person at a time when they're really at their wit's end, we're like, wow, this movement belongs on college campuses. These students need this, which was really surprising, because from the beginning, I think in every interview that I've given and every person that I've talked to that is over, like, I hate to say it, but, like, over the age of, like, 40 or whatever, would naturally say that my generation would not be the generation that would want to sit down and write letters to one another. And yet, this is our main demographic, is millennials, is young people that are tired of always being behind the screen and want to do something with their hands.
You know, when you mentioned earlier that what you're doing is very out of the box, is this basically, I guess you can say, your career that you've carved out for yourself?
Yeah, I started it. It blew up. I ended up basically taking a leap of faith, quitting my full-time job at the time it was Save the Children. I was on their PR team. I was chosen as one of the final participants for the TED Global Talent Search. And I mean, I hadn't even really known anything about TED Talk. Somebody just told me that I should share my story. And so I found out that TED was doing a global talent search, and I applied, and they actually took my audition tape and put it up on TED.com one random day in November of 2012. And as a result, that went viral, and that propelled me into speaking all over the place at different colleges, universities, conferences, something that I still do to this day. I travel like 3 to 4 times a month for speaking engagements. And from that led to the book. And so it just kind of was this natural transition, which was crazy for me because it's my dream to continue to write books and continue to talk on these issues and continue to create projects that really inspire this corner of the world, the internet, whatever you want to call it. But I think that if I had not lived this story first, I would have never been able to walk into that career confidently, knowing I am a writer and I am a speaker, and this is not the only story I'm going to tell. This is just the first of many stories that I'm going to tell.
That was actually what I wanted to ask you next. Is there any possibility that you might write fiction in the future?
I am right now working on a second book that is really more on faith than it is anything else. So the love letters are not in this book, but it is all creative nonfiction. I would like to continue doing both. I really would. I think that I love working with real material, and I love the idea that you have to go out and you have to live a good life in order to write about it.
Yeah, isn't that a great research?
Right? Yeah. It's like, if I want to go and speak on stages and write books about being a good human, I have to go out and be a good human. I can't just do it from behind the screen. And yeah. So I want to continue doing that. I do want to write fiction. I've always wanted to write fiction. And so I'm hoping to get into that in the years to come.
If you had a dream topic that you'd love to write about for fiction, what would it be?
My mind works in the way that Gillian Flynn's mind works. It's like Gone Girl style. And, you know, I really would love to write a story at some point. It would probably fall under the category of YA, just because that seems to be what I'm gravitating towards, or the root of the story. But I want to write a love story at some point that deals with the topic of drug addiction. I come from a very small town, one of the top 100 places to live in the United States. And we have a we have a blaring heroin epidemic going on right now. And so it's very hard to see the news stories about it, but then to also know that when we were in high school, this was going on with all of my friends and no one ever talked about it. And so I would love to, I know that's heavy and hard hitting, but struggling,
it's real. Yeah.
It's real. And struggling with a brother who has been addicted to drugs for the last 15 years and also going through high school and college in a relationship with somebody who was an addict. I think that it is a topic that needs to be talked about more, even though it's hard to talk about it. And I think it's a topic that needs to be assessed with more grace than it currently is assessed with.
Seeing what happened with your brother, how do you think that's affected you growing up?
It's hard. It really rocked my family. It has continued to rock my family. There's no way that you can have somebody who is an addict in your family and not feel like it isn't torn apart in a lot of ways. But yeah. I think of anything, my mom had said, you know, we have struggled with depression and OCD in the past. We come from a background of very extreme personalities, that if you love something, you love it a lot. If you're addicted to something, you're very addicted to it. We have addictive personalities. And so I think I'm lucky that for me, that addiction kind of worked in a different way. It made me very driven and it made me want to pursue good and it made me want to make my parents proud. And I know that my parents' happiness is not contingent on whether or not I shine, but I think that watching my brother have so much life taken from him because of a few dumb decisions he made when he was young and didn't realize what he was doing to his brain has just only fueled me to want to be more driven and be more accomplished and really make much of my life, because I see every single day how hard it can be to build up and overcome an addiction when you make a few unfortunate choices.
I feel for you and have compassion for what your family is going through. And I'm so happy that you have someone like your mom in your life to just be that guiding light.
Yeah.
You both are incredible. And you, Miss, are a rock star, Miss Kick-Ass, doing so many amazing things. You know, when you think about turning despair into beauty, you know, and affecting so many people around you, thousands of lives. It's really beautiful what you've done and I admire you. Yeah. So Hannah, I'd love to know, what's your favorite book or books that you can recommend to us to check?
Love everything. Anne Lamott, she's one of my favorites. Yes. I don't know if you've ever read her, but she's just, oh, she's so kick-ass. And the way that she assesses faith, I'm like, you are the bomb. I have a book right now next to me called Scary Close by Don Miller. It's the subtitle of it is Dropping the Act and Finding True Intimacy. And this book just kind of preaches to me and reads so many books. I'm trying to think if there's anything recently fiction-wise that I've read. I love classics, though. So I think that if ever I'm revisiting, it's kind of my favorite book would be Beloved by Toni Morrison. Or I love Their Eyes Were Watching God. Anything Flannery O'Connor.
That wraps up our episode with Hannah Bruncher. Hannah, thank you again for being so transparent and open during our conversation. Your work is so inspiring. Listeners, I hope you love today's episode as much as I do. Please send your love to Hannah over on Twitter at Hannah Bruncher. For the books and resources mentioned in today's episode, please be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Hannah Bruncher. One more thing before we finish up today's episode. I've been listening to your comments and feedback about wanting to publish your work. I truly believe you'll want to hear what our sponsor has to offer, especially if you're a writer or a poet. Vermont College of Fine Arts has two writing programs I want to tell you about. Their MFA in Writing is one of the original low residency programs, and frankly, one of the best in the country. Writers gather at VCFA's beautiful campus for two separate 10-day residencies each year. Imagine yourself immersed in a setting much like an intense writer's retreat where you're fully committed to workshops, lectures, and readings. After the residencies, you return home and work with a dedicated faculty advisor throughout the rest of the semester. The MFA in Writing and Publishing is their very first and brand new residential program that also focuses on improving your writing and giving you the tools to thrive in the arts. Every student learns directly from agents, editors, and publishers. The cool thing is that it's a cross-genre program, which means if you're a poet, you're encouraged to learn from faculty in fiction or nonfiction. Imagine yourself learning and creating in this incredible writing community, all while living on their gorgeous campus in Montpelier, Vermont. Be sure to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/VCFA to learn more about these programs and their MFA in Writing for Children and Young Adults.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!